Hello, this week we've devoted the entire edition of Music Matters to just one subject, the great Austrian cellist and conductor, Nikolaus Ahnenkohl.
The great works of history, they have no time. Music of Mozart or of Bach or Monteverdi, that is always up to date, that is never old music. We are always on search. We're never there. There is no proper interpretation of anything. The kiss of the muse is the real property. Must be never dogmatism in art. In art, it counts only the result.
One of the most brilliant and provocative musical minds of our age, Nikolaus Ahnenkohl was born into a highly musical and noble Austrian family. He was christened Count Nikolaus de la Fontaine und Ahnenkohl unverzagt. Ahnenkohl joined the Vienna Symphony Orchestra in 1952 while he was in his 20s. He was a cellist and he stayed there for 17 years, serving under conductors like Otto Klemperer and Herbert von Karajan. But within a year of joining the orchestra, Ahnenkohl and a small band of renegade musicians had also formed a breakaway amateur group called Concentus Musicus Wien. Their aim was to seek out Baroque and early music and to perform it in the spirit that it should be played, paying attention to historical methods and using instruments from the time that those works were written, or the closest copies that they could find. The group started nothing less than a revolution in performance practice, changing the musical landscape forever. One of the band's major achievements has been a vast 20-year project which saw Concentus record all of Bach's sacred cantatas in collaboration with the Dutch harpsichordist and conductor, the late Gustav Leonhardt. Concentus Musicus is still thriving today, still led by Nikolaus Ahnenkohl as a vehicle for his constantly evolving ideas of how to breathe life into the music of the past. And Ahnenkohl himself, now in his 80s, remains a dynamic musical force. He's coming to the UK later this month to receive the prestigious Royal Philharmonic Society Gold Medal. He'll also be performing Beethoven's monumental Missa Solemnis with the Concertgebouw, one of the small handful of orchestras that this conductor has developed a deep relationship with over several decades. I went to see Nikolaus Ahnenkohl at his home in the Austrian countryside. It's an impressive baronial building dating back to the mid-15th century. It's a place almost from another time, with no internet access, and where Ahnenkohl himself never even speaks on the telephone if he can help it. He doesn't give many interviews and is notoriously not keen on small talk, but I found him to be charming, relaxed, still passionately engaged with every aspect of music and culture. I began by asking Nikolaus Ahnenkohl to take me back to the start, to his very earliest musical memories.
Whatever the family did was always ornamented by song. But it was not just a pleasure. It was an important, essential part of life.
My father, I think there was no day in his life from his 10th birthday or so on where he did not compose. He thought in music, and the younger brother of my father went totally poor to America and became then director of the Museum of Modern Art. He was for 20 years, from 1948 to 1968, he was director of the Museum of Modern Art. He was a friend of Picasso, he was a friend of Gershwin, and he was the one who made us survive after the war, because he sent us parcels with clothes and parcels with food. And in the 1930s, he sent my father the piano scores of everything which was composed in America, which was interesting. And I think I'm the first one who heard Porgy and Bess, because my father played it on the piano, and while playing the piano, he sang the singing parts. He could do that. And so all this music crept under the piano when I was small. And so music was always part of my life. My interest was wooden sculptures. I made a marionette theater, and I made this and that. And I played cello. I had, by fortune, because he was a refugee in the war, I had the best cello teacher in Europe.
This was Paul Grummer, your teacher?
He was the latest cellist of the Busch Quartet. And he said, I teach you, but only if you promise that you become professional. I don't teach amateurs. So I said, I will become professional, but I never thought I will really do it. I thought it's a great lie. And I think he laid the foundation of what I think about string instrument playing. And when I found out that I cannot live from marionette theater, there was not possible to get any subsidies. Impossible. It was impossible. So I stopped it from one day to the other after great success.
I mean, you had 20 performances of a single production in Graz, didn't you?
At least 20 performances. And I'm sure, today still sure, that it was the best marionette theatre ever existing.
What was the passion for puppets? What was that about?
For me, the movement of a real actor was ridiculous. When I make a puppet, I can say, if this puppet has this character, he has this kind of movements. What you can do with puppets, you can make everything exactly as you see it or as you imagine it.
There's a fascinating link there, it seems to me, between that notion of wanting to sculpt and create a whole world and wanting to finesse movement and make puppets emote and somehow communicate something. Does that in any way feed into the sense of what you're trying to do musically, that there's something about wanting to shape a world, wanting to create a sense of something that speaks?
I think, for me, all arts were always part of one thing. And for me, you can connect the way of movement with language. You can connect the way of movement with musical phrase. You must connect musical phrases with language. Poetry, sculpture, music, everything is somehow coming from one source. And if you add painting, it's the same. I feel always very related to any fantastic painter or poet or sculptor. I'm sorry not to be a composer because I'm not able to create music, but I think I'm able to understand it.
I want to take you back to the very beginning of your performing career, when you start playing in the Vienna Symphony Orchestra in 1952. Can you look back from now and give us a sense of what that sound world was like? Not just of the Vienna Symphony, but the sound world that you entered as a young cellist. This is the age of Furtwängler and Karajan and Bruno Walter. What did orchestra sound like then? And what was it like to be in the middle of that?
I think the difference of the orchestras were much greater than it is today. The two Viennese orchestras sounded a little bit different, but they both had something in common, which was Austro-Czech. It was Austrian and Czech. I was very astonished when I read the names of my colleagues at the Vienna Symphony. Half of the musicians had Czech names. There is a very special approach to music of the Czech musicians. There was a time in the 18th century when all French horn players were Czech. one said that you have to have a check for horn playing because nobody else could. The French, oh, they play their horn, it's impossible. And the English, oh, terrible. And the only right way to play a horn is known by the Czechs. And there are some instruments Hungarians play, most interesting. They're very important for string playing. I don't know if I can say that in English, if it's allowed, but the gypsy musicians, they were not amateurs, but they were like high professionals. And there was a time when the concertmasters of the Vienna Philharmonic were gypsies. And the way they played a piece of a dance or even just a melancholic piece of music, you could not hear in another part of the world. Then the American-Hungarian conductors came again to Europe after the war. Most of them were already conducting before the war, and I hated them. I hated the sound of the American orchestras. I said, how this kind of perfection, when every note is exactly on this place and not on that, and sounding like this and not on that, and when Georges Sell, I think I played 100 concerts with him as a conductor, and he can be happy that I have not killed him. because there was not 1 minute of music making. And when I listened to the discs, which were praised as the best discs in the world, I cannot understand that. What Sell did in America and what he tried to do with us was, for me, he didn't know anything about music. So, and like a man like Klemperer, he said, Sell, forget him. But he was a kind of a god then. And all the American orchestras tried to imitate his way of playing. And then another Hungarian conductor came to Chicago, and the famous Chicago Brass. And this is, for me, it's no brass at all, because the Americans are so afraid to make a crack on a tone that they shorten their instruments. Every instrument is as short as possible because then the next tone is far away and you cannot crack. For me, security and beauty are not compatible. When you seek beauty, you have to forget security and you have to go to the rim of catastrophe. And there you find the beauty. If a musician makes a mistake, a crack, because he risked everything to get the most beautiful thing and he failed, then I thank him for this failure, because it is only with this risk you can get the beauty, the real beauty. The real beauty is not available at all. But if you seek security, you should make another profession.
But you must have found yourself completely at odds with most of the musical world, because their perception of beauty was about polish and refinement and a kind of voluptuousness of sound. And there are you in the early 50s thinking, this is completely wrong. What did you decide to do about that then? And why did you feel it was your mission, your job, to go and change that?
I don't felt that I have to change anything. I read a lot. I read all the tutors, beginning with Diego Ortiz of 1500 something, and all the tutors of Leopold Mozart, and the English tutors like Geminiani. He was Italian, but he lived in England. And I tried to understand what they really meant, not the words, but the meaning. And I found out that it was very similar to what I felt, and all this source knowledge was never, for me, dogmatic.
One thing that you've said about the modern symphony orchestra, you've said already you hated the Georges Sell sound, that sense of creeping internationalism and similarity that was coming into play in European orchestras. You've described that symphony orchestra sound as an unsorted blend of geniality, 19th century tradition and ignorance. That's pretty damning. And it also sounds like you were very frustrated. You must have been frustrated by the sound that orchestras were making at that time.
At what time?
This is, I suppose, just as you're about to set up Concentus Musicus.
Now, what I was frustrated was that they used the sound that they had, the different orchestras had, used for anything, for everything. They played Handel or Bach like Brahms, or you can say they played Brahms like Handel, one could not feel a reason why they're playing this in that way and this in that way. There were very few musicians, very few, but there were some. For instance, Rudolf Serkin was one of the, or Adolf Busch and Casals, and there were some. With them you had not to discuss anything because they knew how to make. And Alfred Deller was one of those. He could make enormous mistakes stylistic, but it was not necessary to tell him, because if a genius, ingenious musician makes a mistake, then it is not a mistake. Then it is the thing. So collaboration with musicians like him is easy, and then I would never be frustrated. When Erich Kleiber, the father of Carlos Kleiber, the real Kleiber, when he conducted, I played sometimes with him. I think he was one of the greatest conductors that I've ever played with. And in this moment, if I had more chance with more musicians to, then I would not have left the orchestra.
Extraordinarily scary time in some ways when you set up Concentus Musicus, because you have all these players, this renegade band of early musicians who are finding the way where there has not been a path before. And I know you had to buy instruments, you had to use family money to try and amass the instruments for this orchestra. There must have been incredible privations and things that you had to go
instruments
without.
Instruments and music. The music we played was not printed at that time. There was not the possibility of internet. We had to go to Bologna to copy music, to Paris to copy music, to Czechoslovakia, to Olmütz and copy. We used everything we earned for that.
And for 5 years you didn't even give a concert. You were just rehearsing and rehearsing, weren't you? Just to get the sound right.
Yes.
Was there ever a point during those very early days where you thought, what have I embarked on? This is crazy.
No, because the target, I don't know if that's the right word, the goal, was not to make something very official. We did not do that to become a concert group. We played in our flat, we rehearsed in our flat every 3 minutes. Sometimes friends came listening. One of them was Robbins Landon. You know him. So he and another friend said, after some years, you have to make that official, not just in your flat. It was not a plan, but we hired a hall in the Palace Schwarzenberg. We studied and rehearsed, and we played 12 concerts of Bononcini to play one of them in the concert. We hired the hall, we make the advertisement, and we will see if people will come or not. And the concerts from the beginning were outsold. And they came in from Vanguard and said, we have to make records together. And the chief of the Deutsche Grammophon came and said, we have to make records. And the chief of Telefunken. And it was not easy, because I didn't want to breed specialists. I wanted to have musicians who are playing in the normal orchestras. There was not one musician who played only a baroque instrument and did not allow them to specialize, even if they were very good. It's still a great problem for me if I listen to a group who plays just baroque music. Because if they play just baroque music, they should eat just baroque food. And music is so much connected with life. The great works of history, they have no time. A work of Leonardo da Vinci will always be modern. And the works of the great Greek sculptures will always be modern. Music of Mozart or of Bach or Monteverdi, that is always up to date. That is never old music.
So it was never a question for you of dogma, of saying we will perform music from 1400 to 1800 because we want to expose everything about that musical world. It was about saying there are jewels here.
Find out the masterworks. I'm ashamed that I don't do more contemporary music. This is the wound point of my life, that I'm so much concentrated on early music that the music of our time... I have done one first performance of Berio, and the threshold to which I went is about 1935.
Yes, I mean, you've done Gershwin and Bartok. And
yes, 1935. Gershwin is 1935. Bartok, the pieces we did, 1935. And Alban Berg, Lulu, 1935. Violin concert and
Is there some cut-off point that the music of your own lifetime, you can't go there?
I don't know. I cannot explain that.
Do you think you will ever go there, that there will be a time and some space to explore that music?
No, now I'm cutting there and there and there and there. You see, as long as I'm eager to find out things, and even in the well-known pieces... I can see I have to perform that again because I've not understood this or that. As long as I'm not too old to perform. But in the moment, just the routine comes and I just repeat what I've already done, then I have to stop. Because repetition as such is not allowed in art. You will not find in my calendar 4th Symphony of Brahms every year 10 times or so. When I do unfinished Symphony of Schubert, I cannot die every day. This is impossible. If I play this kind of piece, I have to stop playing it for 10 years.
So once you've steeped yourself in all this research about a particular piece and you've sought out every original fragment of manuscript and document that you can... There's never always a complete picture, a definitive picture of a score. Does that mean there is room in your mind for interpretation and questions of judgment about whether to use modern instruments for Beethoven or to try and assemble a period instrument group? Or do you not allow yourself that latitude? How hardline are you about these decisions?
The last word is the taste. I don't feel obliged to do what was done then. Because I'm not the warden of a museum. It is not only the question, how was it performed then? And this is the best way for that. The Magic Flute in 1791 is another piece than the Magic Flute in 2012. And even if I say, but it is so much closer to the work by itself if I use the original bassett horns and the trombones and all that. It could be that one or the other part of the work has because of the performances for generations and generations, for 200 years, that this has changed the work itself. And I cannot go against that. Then I would be more dogmatic than the most dogmatic church people. There must be never dogmatism in art. In art, it counts only the result.
I'd like to talk about your Bach Cantatas project, which even now is so extraordinary to look at. To embark upon that, a recording project that takes 20 years to record the complete Bach Cantatas. Did you have any idea of how much that would take over a vast part of your life when you started out on that?
No. We had no idea. There was an old friendship between me and Gustav Leonhardt. He came from Basel, where he studied harpsichord. He came to Vienna in 1949. And there was a time when we played every day together. And he was the only musician with whom I did not need rehearsals. When I played gamba sonatas with him, we could go on the stage without rehearsal.
Why? Because there was a sense of a sort of kindred spirit.
I felt he could only make that, and he felt he could only make that. And then there is a spontaneity which you cannot have with much rehearsing. It was absolute singular thing. And the producer said, "This is so interesting, we have to make it." And we said we should make that together.
So how did you and Leonhardt decide to carve up the music between you, to divide the music?
We said, which work now for the next 2 years or 3 years, which work do you want really to make? And which one work do you want really to make? And there were already, at this point, was already a very, very clear division. Somehow, because of the musicians we had available, somehow because of a very special interest. And there were 2-3 works, not very many, we both wanted to make.
Who won?
No, we did never struggle. I don't remember that we once had a struggle about that.
There was never a point in my lifetime where these recordings were not available. Yeah. I can't remember not knowing about the sound of early music and the way it should sound. There must have been a point for you where it was like opening a door to a past world, that there was something so staggeringly new and exciting about the sound that these musicians were making when they were playing Monteverdi and Bach. Do you remember that feeling of novelty and the excitement of it?
I remember in the time when I was studying music in the academy, we had a very small group of 4 or 5 musicians, met every Wednesday afternoon and played through the whole library of the academy. And when we need a singer, we ask a singer to join us. When we need a pianist, we ask a pianist. We found out that it is not the same to play chamber music of Hindemith and a chamber music of Bach or of Mozart. There are a lot of monasteries in Austria which were secularized by Joseph II in about 1780 or even earlier. And in these monasteries, you find almost always a chest in the organ, and in this chest, a few instruments. And those instruments were never played from 1770, 1890 to the moment I play them. The other 2-3 members of this little group of students They knew this monastery, and I went to that monastery, and they lent us the instrument for a time. And I was very keen in woodworking, so I did bridges for these instruments and adjusted them, sometimes with the help of violin makers, that one could play them. And then we found out that there's an essential difference in the speaking of the instruments, and that this difference is not just because they are primitive or because they are old, but it is different. Something is easier to produce, some idea is given by the instrument. The instrument is kind of inspiration to playing, especially string instruments. Very soon I found out what this instrument or that instrument wanted to produce, and I think I had a good feeling for the ability of the instrument itself.
If these instruments somehow do tell stories of their own past, that there's something more to them, as you've said, than just being a wooden box that can make a beautiful sound, is that part of the allure for you of revisiting the past, that it's about somehow telling the stories of music that otherwise wouldn't exist in their proper form, that it's about giving a true reflection of what music should be and should have sounded like?
Yeah, yes. But I'm a little bit afraid by words with, like, proper form, because I don't think that there is a proper form. We're always on search. We're never there. And there is no proper interpretation of anything. The kiss of the muse is the real property. A mistake can be more inspiring than the proper thing.
As you said, you were a performer for many years, and yeah. I know you didn't get onto the podium with a major orchestra, I think, until you were in your 40s. And you're not very enamoured of the whole maestro idea, are you? You're not interested in being a maestro. Why not?
Because for me, maestro is a hairdresser. The only person to whom I said maestro was the hairdresser in Italy. And he's called maestro by everybody. And when I was a young cellist, there was only one Italian conductor, Massimo Freccia, who was called maestro. Karajan, Böhm, Gleiber, nobody was called maestro. Böhm wanted to be called Dr. Böhm because he said it's the only thing he studied was Dr. Law. Karajan said Herr von Karajan, and he has done a lot politically to keep the von in his name.
But you don't really like the idea of these sort of superconductors with their huge egos, whether they're called maestro or not. It seems to me you're very much not that kind of a conductor, are you?
No. If you read the advertising of a concert, if you read the old advertising, you have a so great print for the composer, and then the conductor is somewhere. He's not on an important place. The composer is an important place, but not the conductor. And then from generation to generation, the composer becomes smaller and the conductor becomes bigger. And now the audience doesn't go to listen to a work, it goes to this magician on the stage. And this is a distortion of the art.
So do you see yourself first and foremost then as a conductor or a practicing musician or a musical historian and thinker?
No, musical historian and thinker I'm only at home. When we started with Concentus, we said we change the leadership for every program we study. And it turned out that it always fell back to me. Maybe this is my profession, to be the leader. In the earlier times, the orchestras said sometimes, the ones to play with studied conductors, that you can study conducting. But the question is, what is that? What is that? To beat one of the good conductors like Klemperer said, I can tell to my, what is Putzfrau?
Cleaner.
Yeah? Yeah. I can teach her conducting in an hour. If there is a 5/4 meter, I need another hour. In the early times, Bach had never studied conducting. He took a paper, roll of music, so that everybody in the chorus could see him, and showed with his hands what he wanted. And I found out that this is very easy. I can do that, even so-called complicated works like Bartok. If the orchestra agrees, it's easy to show what you mean. The important thing is to find out what the work will tell. And this is almost impossible to teach. Facts. There are some facts, but it is not so clear.
You've worked with a handful of orchestras over your career, 4 or 5 orchestras who you come back to repeatedly, who you build these very deep relationships with. One of whom is the Concertgebouw, who you're coming to London with.
They were the first who dared to take me.
Well, they dared to take you, and the relationship has been a very long-lasting one.
Yes.
What is it that you found that you love with the sound of that orchestra, and what have you tried to change and adapt to your way of thinking?
I cannot say what I want to change, because I don't want to change anything. An orchestra develops a kind of personality, a collective personality. A good orchestra. This disappears a bit in the last generation. The orchestras of the world sound more and more similar. But for me, as an Austrian musician, uncommon open mind for ideas. This is, I think, is still very strong in that orchestra. I don't think that there are many musicians still there who were with me in the beginning, but even the changing orchestra is an orchestra with great curiosity.
But it's not only about that sense of a culture and a philosophy of this changing organism, this orchestra where the players change all the time. It's also, it must be about the excitement of playing with players where they have that incredible string sound, where the brass is so wonderful in that orchestra, where the winds play so beautifully. It must also be like driving a Rolls Royce.
Yes, but yes, you're right.
But you really expect your audience to do a bit of work, it seems to me. When you produce a new disc, there are very often scores or texts or accompanying notes, essays. You expect your audience to really actively engage with listening. It's not a passive activity, is it, listening?
No, they cannot go ironing while they listen to it, because the iron would stop and the shirt would be burned.
So you do it to keep people's, for health and safety reasons. It is really essential, though, I think, for you, it seems, that it's not just a question of giving out this music and expecting it to go out there and people can sit there passively. You want your audience to give something back, that the relationship between the musicians and the audience has to be a dynamic one.
Yes, yes.
Why is that so important?
I think because music is a language. And a language needs not only listeners, but also people who answer, who react, at least react. You cannot have always answering people, but reacting is absolutely necessary.
Let's talk about the composers who you don't want to perform, who you're not interested in, because you've been very vocal about this over the years, that you don't have any interest in Mahler, that you don't particularly like the music of Berlioz, or you can't see yourself ever doing Wagner. Is there a shared quality in the composers whose music you are not interested in.
Yes.
What is it?
It's different with the names you called. I can imagine to... It's now maybe too late, but I can imagine to perform one or two works of Wagner. I did already the Ouverture and the Bacchanal in Tannhäuser. And in a special program with three friend enemies of Wagner, Mendelssohn and Schumann.
But you only did Wagner in the context of Mendelssohn and Schumann, because that made sense for you there.
Yeah. I could imagine to do Tristan, but it's too late now. And I could imagine to make Meistersinger as what this really is, as an operette. It would then be not far away from Offenbach.
So given that you say you don't have time now to, say, conduct Meistersinger, are there regrets for you about the music that you haven't been able to cover? I mean, you've made more than 500 recordings. That is a vast amount of music to have recorded. Yeah. But is there still more that you wish you had been able to do?
I regret not to have made more by Alban Berg. I was on the edge to make the performance of Lulu in Salzburg. And then I became sick in autumn and I lost 1 month because of hospital and so. And I saw that if I have not the preparation of this month included, I cannot do it, and I cancelled it. I regret not to have done a performance of Lulu and not Wozzeck.
When you come to London and you step onto the podium, the Concertgebouw there, and you're about to perform the Missa Solemnis, what's the feeling even now as you stand on the podium, just before you're about to start performing a piece? Is there still that visceral thrill and excitement about doing this?
Yes. You're a little bit too small for the task. This is the feeling. One can call it is a bit of being afraid, but it is just a bit of that. And you know that you can never reach the point which you have to reach.
You've talked before about the French Revolution as this monumental turning point in music and culture. And you did very much start a revolution of your own in the middle of the 20th century that continues today, the waves of which are still being felt, this early music revolution. Where will the future revolutions be in terms of performance? What will the future battlegrounds be?
The question becomes bigger and bigger, what is music about as a whole? You can see that in the papers when they speak about music, it's less and less the Beethoven of our time. What would he do? Would he build bridges? Or
do you see yourself then in a way as one of the last in the line, a sort of keeper of the Holy Grail, that part of your job is to keep this tradition alive?
No, I don't estimate myself as being something. I do what I do, and I don't see myself in possession of holy figures.
Of the Benedictus from Beethoven's Missa Solemnis, performed by the Chamber Orchestra of Europe and the Arnold Schoenberg Choir, conducted by Nikolaus Arnoncourt. And that Music Matters Nikolaus Arnoncourt edition was presented by Susie Klein. The producer was Paul Frankel.